Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Audra, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. And today's workshop is focused on diverse populations participating in decisions about your care with your healthcare team. And this is part two of how healthcare disparities may influence your cancer treatment and care. And today's activity is supported by Novartis Oncology and an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on the program today, and we also have wonderful participants as well on the call today. And we're delighted to have all of you on the call today. We have over 155 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, the Philippines, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is truly a global call as well. And I'm just so delighted to have all of you on the call today. Terrific. And we're going to begin with our esteemed speakers on the call today. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mandy Pratt Chapman. And Dr. Chapman is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, School of Medicine and Health Sciences, Associate Professor, Department of Prevention and Community Health, Milken Institute School of Public Health, Associate Director, Community Outreach and Engagement, GW Cancer Center. And Dr. Chapman will be addressing how being a member of diverse communities may impact your access to oncology care, what to expect from your relationship with your healthcare team and your healthcare team, is your healthcare team providing you with equitable, excellent care? It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Pratt Chapman.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here on this panel with so many wonderful colleagues. So I'll first just say that both of these questions, accessing care regardless of your background and getting excellent care from your care team is very personal. And while I will make some general statements, obviously, I'm not saying that if you're from any particular background, something is going to be a certain way. We just have kind of some general statements in terms of what the landscape looks like and some things to keep in mind. So in an ideal world, regardless of your lived experience, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, nationality, or language would not affect your access to care. However, in the U.S., the majority of oncologists are still majority white and male. And what that means is that people who get cancer that are not white males may have trouble finding a provider that has a shared lived experience. Why does that matter? It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get bad care, but there have been studies that show that sometimes communication or information gaining, participation in decisions can suffer if patients have a different background from their doctor. In the U.S., oncologists are generally over 60% are white, over 60% are male, and as of 2022, I'm sorry, yeah, as of 2022, 60% of oncologists were men and 40% were women, with underrepresentation in the Black and Hispanic populations. And we don't really know the representation within the LGBTQI community since we haven't systematically collected those data. I know that the American Society of Clinical Oncology was looking to add those data to their membership demographics. I'm not sure what the status of that is currently and in our current environment. Also importantly, the physician workforce in oncology is older, with a median age of 53 and one in five being older than 64. So again, if you have a different language, nationality, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity than your provider, it just might make communication slightly different, and there might be different assumptions. Yet diversifying the workforce has come under attack, particularly this year, and really, really concerning. Transgender and intersex people are not even recognized by the U.S. government currently. So recent federal actions have increased intimidation among immigrants, both undocumented and documented. And so the denial of the existence of transgender and intersex people, threats to LGBTQI civil rights, refusal to acknowledge the strong impact of 400 years of nation building with whiteness at the center of privilege, makes it more intimidating for people who aren't at that center to access care, know if they can trust their healthcare team. I once did a study a few years ago in 2017, I guess that's more than a few years ago now, on transgender cancer healthcare experiences, and particularly among trans masculine, non-binary, and trans men, there was a strong perception that they didn't want to go to care unless they were in extreme pain or thought they were going to die because of past experiences of discrimination and concerns about interactions with their healthcare team. Of course, this is a qualitative sample. It wasn't generalizable. It was specific to the DC area. And as a qualitative study, I can't say statistically that that transfers to any kind of population level, but the stories were very compelling. And it's, fear of discrimination is reasonable when you've had past experiences of discrimination or when current political realities are not acknowledging your existence or your civil rights. And importantly, people in rural areas that are usually majority white also continue to face challenges to accessing cancer care. So it's not just an issue of race. It's really an issue of access to privilege, power, and proximity to cancer care. So what do we do about these things? So diversity in the workforce is really important. Training, both diversity in training and diversity in lived experience, including all of the things that I've mentioned, race, ethnicity, language, sexual orientation, gender identity, even geographic upbringing. I was raised in a rural area, spent most of my life in an urban area, but that attention and sensitivity to what it's like to try to access care from a very rural state is always center of my mind. And this diversity in workforce can help increase the opportunity for concordance between patients and clinicians in terms of background and culture, because it does matter to quality care. Other solutions, partnerships between urban and rural oncology so that high-quality care can be closest to home, and optimizing telehealth and video conferencing. That's definitely another strategy, and certainly civic engagement to ensure civil rights protections for everyone. Moving to what to expect from your relationship with your healthcare team, this is highly, highly personal. It's a challenging thing to know. Anecdotally, in a current study that I'm leading, we're in year four of the study, we asked patients of all backgrounds if they felt discriminated against by asking them questions from the Everyday Discrimination Scale, such as, are you treated with less courtesy, less respect, or poorer service than other patients? And really, nearly everyone reported very high-quality care and positive interactions from their cancer care team. Yet when we asked them to describe experiences of care, many people described experiences that were not really optimal. So what do we do with this information? First of all, I think cancer care is a very unique kind of healthcare. It's scary, and patients may not know what quality care looks like. Often you haven't had cancer previously. You haven't had to see an oncologist. And even if they do have a sense of what quality care looks like, it's probably unlikely that they're going to have a sense of whether their care looks different from the person that saw the same doctor before them or after them. And so, I mean, I think specific to me and research lessons learned, I think the measure that we use may be just too blunt an instrument for cancer care experiences where there's such a strong bond between patients and their oncology team. And really, I've never met anyone working in oncology that wanted to provide bad care, much less discriminatory care. However, you know, even though that measure didn't quite do the job, I think there are some questions you can ask yourself in terms of expecting high quality care. So the first question you can think about is, does your oncologist and your oncology team have extensive experience with patients that have the type of cancer you need to be treated for? This is probably the most important question to ask. And do you feel comfortable with them? Do they have experience treating people like you? But really, their experience with the type of cancer that you have and the volume of patients is a major criteria for quality care. Is your doctor following evidence-based guidelines from the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, from the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and the American Society of Radiation Oncology? There are, of course, interpretations and tailoring that has to happen, but generally there should be an evidence base for your treatment planning. And if you are eligible for a clinical trial, you should also be aware of that. That can sometimes be the best kind of cancer treatment you could get. Are you given space to share your priorities and goals of care? Are the people that you want with you in your appointments? So do you feel comfortable bringing your partner or the support person that you feel most comfortable with to accompany you to appointments? Is your care well coordinated so that different providers know what each other are doing and your treatment plan is taking all aspects of your care into consideration? Are you asked about your emotional well-being in addition to your physical symptoms? And more, I think folks are doing this, but are you asked about social barriers that might make it harder for you to get to or complete treatment and then offered assistance in resolving those potential challenges? Are you asked about and offered relief from pain? And are you understanding the information that you receive? Are you able to ask questions to clarify anything you don't understand? Do you feel welcome and safe in the clinical environment and with your care team? You should trust your instincts. And have you been informed about financial considerations so that expenses are not a surprise? So these are just some things that you could jot down in terms of, you know, really trusting yourself to, you know, do you feel like you're getting high quality care? These are some of the things that you can ask yourself and explore in terms of what you're getting for care. And I know I have met my time and I will hand it on to my colleague, but I am happy to stay on and thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much. Dr. Pratt Chapman, that was just an extraordinary presentation and really set the stage for today's program. You're the first speaker, and so you really have set just a beautiful stage for today's program. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is NFM Scout, and Dr. Scout is Executive Director, National LGBT Cancer Network, VP of Social Justice, the Torvis Group, Los Angeles, California. And Dr. Scout will be addressing key questions to ask your healthcare team about your treatment plan and how being a member of diverse communities may impact treatment, management of treatment side effects, and pain. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Scout.
Excellent. Thanks, Carolyn. I appreciate it. I always like being on these, and I actually kind of love the fact that it's audio only. It makes it easy to listen to and kind of extra delightful to present on. So, you know, I spent a lot of time, listening to the experiences of sexual and gender minority cancer survivors in many different situations, whether they have good ones or bad ones. It's interesting because actually we do find a phenomenon that's very similar to what Mandy was talking about there, that there's a lot of us who say that we're having really great experiences with our providers. But then if you actually dig into what those experiences are, we report out that they are not actually as good as others. So there's this phenomena in, there's this scientific arena in the medical world called patient-centered outcomes. And just to explain it at its very briefest, it's that if you have two different providers who are giving you the exact same treatment interventions, like the same pills, the same radiotherapy, everything like that. But you like one provider more, it has been proven that you will be healthier with the provider you have a better connection with. So we know that patient-centered care is actually a little contradictory to what we have understood, because when we often say, like, is someone giving us good care, we don't think about the relationship we have with that provider. We think about, do we think we're getting the same pills or the same radiotherapy or the same chemo as the person next to us? And what I'd like to do, really, if I leave you with any one thing in my 6 minutes here, is to say that there is a science base that shows that if you have a better relationship with your provider, you will be healthier at the end of the day. And for many of us in underserved and historically discriminated against populations, we're not used to having those good relationships with our providers. And we also don't feel as if it's justifiable to leave a provider if they feel like they're being chilly to us. We may think, oh, but, you know, they're the best in their class, something like that. You know, the care is really great. Horrible bedside manner, or it feels like they're throwing shade, but I'm going to go after the good care. So I would like to encourage everybody to honestly, as long as you have the resources, and of course in a cancer care situation, that's always a good question because, you know, it's very hard to do things like change providers. But if you have those resources, move to a provider you feel really comfortable with, particularly a provider that you feel willing to talk to about things like racism you've experienced, sexism you've experienced, homophobia, transphobia, things like that. Because we have a tendency to put those in a different bucket and think they don't have to do with our care outcomes. I'm here to say they really, really do. And you deserve an environment where there's no elephant in the room that you're afraid to talk about related to cancer care. And so with that, I also just want to quickly say, especially after being the caregiver for my mother, as she just recently went through her end-of-life experience as a lesbian with cancer, there are some things that are just for all populations that I really think you should be asking your doctor. First of all, we know that a cancer treatment is often an endless waiting game. It feels like there's always one more test to figure out what your next step is going to be. And so that's something that we have to kind of get used to, the fact that you will not know necessarily as much information as you need to at any given visit. It always feels like there's one more question on the horizon. So we have to hold with that uncertainty. But that said, there are people who can really help us decipher it because, you know, just in the same way we say, you know, it's easier to be a grandparent than a parent because, you know, who's used to raising kids when it's your first time around? In the same way, it's really important to connect with people who've seen lots of cancer journeys, if it's our first cancer journey, because that will help us normalize whether what we're doing or going through right now makes sense or doesn't. Just an example, with my mother, after her first chemo administration, they dropped 14 medications on her with only the most scant of directions about when to take these medications. And, you know, here I am being her caregiver trying to help support her. I've got a lot of education. I got a PhD, everything like that. But I'm still totally flummoxed by the fact they say take this one medication 5 times a day and with food. And she's not able to keep an ounce of food down. So how in the world are we supposed to get that medication in 5 times a day? And so what we ended up doing in that scenario was messing up her medications by accident with the best of intentions and with the best of education, simply because we weren't used to the norm. And as soon as we were able to, in this case, consult, there was a company that did palliative and hospice care that could be attached on top of her existing medical providers. Palliative care is pain management. And as soon as we were able to consult those people, they were untwining so many issues for us and showed us that our first step through her chemo was really us stumbling over the medication confusion. And they were able to untwine a lot of that, tailor some of the new medications for the excessive amount of, in this case, nausea that she was experiencing and diarrhea, things like that, change things so that she actually increased her appetite, and also explain to us that the 5 times a day was a hormone that helped you digest food. So if you're eating 5 times a day, take the medication. If you weren't eating, you didn't need the digestion hormone. So it really is important to ask yourself kind of what other support is there. And those people who can help you normalize what's average and routine, since it's often your first experience, makes a huge difference. But then just to move on to some things that are really important, particularly for discriminated against populations. A, what kind of support can you get? So just the last things I really want to say is that you want to get support groups on your side. You want to get as many people who can normalize where you're going through the situation and what is usual and average to help you get to that as possible. But also the real thing you want to do if you're in a discriminated against population is find out if your provider can clear the path to other providers and tell you which ones are actually the ones that are respectful and welcoming in the institution, including calling them in advance to checking, and then checking with you after the fact to make sure your experience really did match that and that they should continue to be kind of on that favored provider status. So you want that for all of the people, but as well, you want to know with them what happens if you experience a provider who does not feel welcoming and supportive. Can you change to another provider? Can you talk to a health system navigator who might know more welcoming providers? Or can you complain about that provider to the institution? Again, the big thing we've got to do is reframe our brain, because we deserve providers who feel like they're actually really supportive of us, not just the providers who give us good pills. And when we reframe our expectations that way, we raise our standards. And achieving those standards, trust me, will mean you have better health outcomes. That is what I was going to say.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Scott. That was really excellent and so very helpful to so many of our participants on the program today. And I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos. And Dr. Palos is former Clinical Protocol Administration Manager, Office of Cancer Survivorship, the University of Texas at MD Anderson Cancer Center, author and researcher in healthcare disparities and caregiving and survivorship. And Dr. Palos will be addressing when to seek a second opinion, finding the best care for you, and how to request copies of treatment and pathology reports, your encounter notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Palos.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for your kind introduction and the invitation to join today's esteemed panel. We heard some really useful, practical information from Dr. Pratt-Chapman and Dr. Scout, and I think it really sets the tone of some of the barriers or challenges that patients face and providers face when trying to access effective treatment, as well as at times the documents or medical records that go along with that. So I'll pick up on some of the things that they have said. I believe most of us on today's call have encountered a situation with a friend, a family member, or even oneself where we were uncertain about a recommended procedure, diagnosis, or treatment. These types of scenarios most likely call for a second opinion. Today, more and more healthcare providers encourage their patients to get a second opinion, particularly when the diagnosis and treatment is related to such a complex disease like cancer. This condition often requires making difficult health conditions across the course of the treatment plan. Now, getting a second opinion is not about doubting your physician's recommendation or expertise. It's a way to validate the diagnosis, the proposed treatment, or to learn about new treatment options or even potential clinical trials that will help you increase or maximize your healthcare outcomes. And patients and families usually have several questions, and this afternoon I'll try to cover a few of those questions. A brief and practical definition of a second opinion is it's about finding the best care for you, and that should be your goal throughout the whole experience of any kind of health encounter that you have. Getting a second opinion takes careful research, planning, and time. For example, there's a need to conduct research to find a provider who best meets your needs. Once the provider has been identified, the planning phase begins. And so steps of this would include requesting and getting your medical records, gathering other documents to help the physician learn about your needs, scheduling the appointment, and getting the new doctor's recommendations. An added step may be to make travel arrangements if the physician is located in another town, city, or state. One of the main reasons folks go out to get a second opinion is when there's a lack of clarity or uncertainty about the diagnosis. This type of situation is an opportunity to seek advice from another physician before deciding which treatment to pursue. In cancer, a second opinion is quite helpful because it's a chronic, often a chronic or long-term condition. So different phases will cover the course of the cancer experience. For example, there may be the newly diagnosed phase, the treatment phase, the follow-up care phase, and the long-term care. And with each phase, there's a need to make new decisions about the treatments. So the more information you have, the better prepared one can be. Remember the research that we talked about earlier? Hopefully your research has helped you identify a specialist who has experience with your medical condition. You can visit the new specialist website and look for information on their training and expertise. You can look for things like fellowships, memberships, and professional organizations, and of course, education. You may even want to go online to look at the reviews from previous patients. Now, once you make that appointment and you're ready to go and see the new provider, be sure, and I hope, well, not I hope, it would be practical to let the office know that you're asking for a consultation so they understand that you may not be there for a long term as a patient, but that you really need to see them for the consultation. When you go to that visit, remember to bring all your medical records and documents that will help the second physician make the best possible recommendation. It's also very helpful to prepare a list of questions ahead of time to ensure that all your concerns are addressed. And of course, once you get the second opinion, you'll need to compare their recommendations with those of the initial recommendations that were made. So what are the benefits of getting a second opinion? Well, I guess two main ones is you feel more confident that the right decision has been made about your treatment plan. And it also increases the opportunity of receiving the most effective treatment that can improve your long-term health. Yet there's some potential challenges to seeking a second opinion. First, there may be a cost, so be sure and check with your insurance provider to ask if a second opinion and any related new tests will be covered. Also, because of this is taken, the planning and the research, there may be a longer wait time to find that second physician to get an appointment and to get additional tests. Another barrier that comes up with the patients to trying to get second opinions is their geographic region, their religious background, their cultural beliefs. So those, for example, who live in rural areas may not be able to get to a doctor's office right away when they're seeking an opinion, or there may be just one provider that's located close to them, so they'll have to travel quite a distance. They're in the metro area, again, that can be a barrier if there aren't any bus lines or things like that to get you to to some place once you've made the second opinion. So there are some challenges with that. And then there's our elderly population who may not have any transportation. And then our LGBTQ+ populations that maybe don't even know that that's an option or are nervous about going to see a new provider because of all the implicit bias that are there. So let's talk a little bit about requesting the medical records. The HIPAA rule of 2003 created national standards to protect individual medical records. And some of you may, when you're going in to see a new doctor or a surgery, they ask you to sign a form that's called the HIPAA form. Well, that form is good because it gives you more control over your health information. And it sets boundaries on the use and release of your healthcare records. So if you're changing physicians, the request needs to be issued in writing. So usually the process is quite straightforward. You may need to fill out an authorization form granting one provider permission, of course, to share your records with another provider. And then on that form, you'll be able to mark what records you would need. And at times there may be a reasonable fee to cover the cost of the transfer, and that would be like for the copies or mailing if that's what you're requesting. In the best case scenarios, your records can arrive within a few days, or sometimes you can even pick them up on that day that you're requesting them. And if your records have not been put into electronic medical records, it can take up to 30 days to complete the transfer under HIPAA regulations. And some you're going to find that at times there's going to be some offices that don't have a set form. So it would be good to develop a letter to request these medical records. And, of course, it will have your demographic and contact information, the list of the medical records that you want to have, and then be sure and let them know how you would like those records. Would you like them on paper, the portal, fax, mail, and of course in person? And be sure and sign it and provide a copy of your government issued ID. Requesting a copy of your medical records is one of your rights as a patient. The law guarantees you this right and protects you from the unreasonable high fees when you request your medical records. In today's healthcare environment, there's no one-size-fits-all solution, so getting a second opinion is often a safe and smart choice. So whether you're dealing with a serious illness, a recommended surgery, a chronic condition, getting a second opinion can be the key to feeling secure in your treatment plan. Always remember that when it comes to your health, it's better to be well-informed than to simply follow advice without question. And I'll be happy to answer any questions. This concludes my remarks, Dr. Messner, and so I'll return the program back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Pallas. That was just a wonderful presentation. Very sterling in every way and very compassionate. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Maria Chi. And Dr. Chi is clinical oncology social worker, author, and researcher in health, determinants of health, psychosocial oncology, and financial toxicity. And Dr. Chi will be addressing what to consider when selecting a cancer care team of and treatment facility, languages spoken, and diversity of the healthcare team. What is cultural humility, and how your care team practices cultural humility, and how to self-advocate with the healthcare team, languages spoken, disability services, and other barriers to health equity, and tips to communicate with your healthcare team to determine if they are the best team for you. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chi.
Finding the best healthcare or treatment team for you is fundamental to your cancer experience because you'll likely be spending much of your time with them for this period in your life. So get to know you quite well, and it's important that you feel comfortable, seen, and heard by the people who have such a big role in your life. Don't be afraid to consult with more than one provider or treatment center, as you're entitled to a second or third or more opinions, which can be very valuable in determining the course of your treatment. Remember, you're interviewing them to be a member of your cancer care team. A helpful question to ask potential providers is, how many people with my type of cancer have you treated? Do you tend to approach cancer care more cautiously or more aggressively with a traditional or standard treatment protocol? Are clinical trials available? How about complementary and alternative treatment approaches? Given that your cancer care team may also include nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants, medical assistants, social workers, etc., one question to ask is, how accessible are these other providers and other support services for both emotional and practical resources at this treatment center? One very other important consideration is in choosing a healthcare team is to assess their practice of cultural humility. Cultural humility is a lifelong process of growth and self-reflection around learning to spot our biases, assumptions, and potentially harmful beliefs about cultures different from our own, as well as trying to develop a deeper understanding and respect for various cultures and perspectives without positioning our own worldview as the only worthwhile one. And remember, culture can include groups of people whose membership is based on religious, racial, ethnic, or other social commonalities or characteristics, people with shared customs, beliefs, practices, and challenges. As the term implies, cultural humility involves adopting an open, humble stance, recognizing that there's always more to learn, and that it's not just about acquiring knowledge of different cultures, but about remaining open and flexible and questioning, continually checking our assumptions and generalizations about groups of people. It's a process that is never complete. So how does cultural humility, or a lack of it, impact our healthcare team and choice of treatment facility? Well, one important thing to do is to observe how providers talk to us
including the treatments they recommend or not, and how they listen to us and answer our questions. Do they seem to take seriously any concerns we may be having, especially in regards to our cultural beliefs and our culture's history of interactions with the healthcare world, or about the level of medical interventions we may prefer and why, or how we may view things like chronic health issues, serious illness, or participating in clinical trials? Do they seem to respect our family dynamics and our decision-making process, including how we talk or don't talk to our families about our health issues and whom we may include in that process? Are they communicating with us as equal partners in our own cancer care decisions? Are there representatives of my culture or cultures on my cancer care team? If not, do they seem to have knowledge or awareness of my unique cultural issues or a desire and an openness to learn? Have they treated other patients from my cultural groups before? How do they treat other members of their team who may belong to different cultural groups or backgrounds? Another key indicator of cultural humility in our prospective cancer care team or treatment facility is whether or not they can ensure clear communication and language services. Having access to verbal health information and written material in our primary language helps reduce miscommunication between patients and healthcare providers, which can affect the quality and safety of our care. Don't be afraid to advocate for yourself by requesting an in-person or a telephone interpreter, someone that can facilitate in real time communication between yourself and your healthcare team during each visit. You are entitled to receive clear, accurate information that you can understand and to ensure that your providers understand the questions and concerns you may have about your own health. If needed, you're also entitled to access disability services in your hospital or treatment center. The Americans with Disabilities Act is a federal law that requires that healthcare facilities provide full and equitable access to their services and facilities. This includes providing communication devices for people with hearing or visual impairments, such as sign language interpreters or materials written in larger print. This also may include ensuring accessible restrooms, exam tables, or other equipment, such as ramps, elevators, and accessible pathways throughout the facility. This may also mean offering assistive devices, such as wheelchairs, canes, or walkers, to people who need them, or offering reasonable practice or policy modifications, like allowing service animals or providing longer appointment times. So finding the healthcare team and treatment facility that is best for you may involve all of these important considerations. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Chi. That was just a wonderful presentation and just very, very informative for all of our participants to be aware of what you're looking for in with your healthcare team. And our next speaker is Dr. Blaz Bush, and Dr. Bush is Executive Director, LGBTQ Plus Health Program, Stanford Medicine, Center for Academic Medicine. And Dr. Bush will be addressing your important role in shared decision making and tips to communicate with your healthcare team to determine if they are the best team for you. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bush.
Thank you so much, and hello, everyone. My name is Blaze Bush, and it's such a pleasure to be here, especially with our wonderful colleagues on the call, who I just think are all incredible leaders. Also, I actually don't have my doctorate, though I do appreciate being elevated to that station, maybe one of these days. So Blaze is totally fine. I'm excited to speak with you all today about, your important role in shared decision making. And I want to bring it back. I think you've already heard this on the call, but that this is a service to you, right? Healthcare services are a service that you are seeking. And so I think it's really important that then your voice is included. And I think about this in a lot of different kind of services where, the customer is right, or people are looking at your needs, what you're interested in receiving, and they're shaping their care for you. I feel like sometimes that really drops off when it comes to healthcare. You would really situate doctors as the experts, which I think is wonderful, and they are the experts when it comes to health, but you are the expert when it comes to you and your healthcare what matters to you, what you want out of healthcare, what your goals are, you know, specific to cancer care, what are your goals, what's most important to you, and your provider and your care team should be shaping their care to meet that need of yours. So you know your body, you know your needs, you know your community and your culture. I remember a patient who had an experience and story where they had an upcoming Pride event. And this was the first time this patient was ever going to be able to ride on a Pride float. And she was so excited and so thrilled that she was having some deteriorating health effects. And when she was in the doctor's office, she was saying, you know, I want to be able to do this. This is so important to me. And I think, you know, what I'm trying to make a distinction on is there's providers and care teams who will say, okay, I understand how important this is to you. Let's see what we can do. You know, I can't promise you're going to fill up to it. I can't promise it's the best decision, but let's look at what your options are and what we can maybe do for your care plan to make sure that you get this experience. There's a difference then in a doctor who acts like, oh, this is not important. Why do you need to go to a Pride parade? Like, why do you need to get out and do this? Or maybe saying like, I really, you know, advise against this. I don't see any reason why this would be so important. You know, that really would send to me a picture that they're not including my voice and it doesn't matter. Again, it may not always be the right decision, but just the willingness to engage in that conversation and be a part of decision-making, I think is really key. You know, given the statistics that Dr. Pat Chapman named at the top of the hour, also realize that many providers likely don't share your lived experience. Thus, they don't know or can't know what it feels like to live your life, which means that you're the expert, you're the voice that's most important informing your provider what you'd like to see this outcome be and how they can best care for you. Along these same lines, you have a right to understand the care. So if they're telling you what you need to do and not engaging with, you know, would this work for you? Does that feel good for you? Do you understand what I'm talking about? Do you understand why this decision may be important? That you have a right to continue to engage in that conversation and ask for more clarification. No one should be frustrated with you for wanting to better understand the care that you're receiving and what that means, or maybe what your other options are. And then I think overall, you know, if you don't feel like you're heard, and I experience this, if I don't feel like I'm being listened to, I'm less likely to engage in that care, less likely to maybe make it to appointments, and less likely to be fully invested with the kind of guidance and homework that I need to be doing. So, you know, I think just having someone that listens to you, that you feel a part of this, also leads to more kind of follow-up and engagement. Switching over quickly to the tips on communication, you know, personally, I always start by looking for specific LGBTQ plus health programs or cancer care centers. Now, there's not a lot of these, but no matter what your community is, see if there is a center that focuses on this or is connected to a good community resource that represents your community. I also always talk upfront. Of course, this is my job, so it's easy to talk about why this is important to me, but my community and kind of why my community is important to me is part of my care. Part of that's also to see how they react and see if they react supportively. And then I'd also always like to talk with my care team about, you know, how can I include people who are important to me, right? Like for LGBTQ folks, your family may not be present in your care, but chosen family, people who may not be related to you but exist as family in your life, may be really essential. So is my care team going to include them in my care and make them part of my treatment? Or even if I bring my husband to an appointment, do they let him come to the room with me, be a part of the care visit? Do they treat him as my partner and my loved one with the same way that I think they would treat anybody's partner? I think that's really important to me. And for some communities, you may have a really large family network. So do they allow for, you know, other individuals to be involved and always kind of welcome them into the room? And then there are some flags that I always look for, even maybe before communication with a team, such as, are there photos on websites, materials in the waiting room that represent me and my community, aka do I see myself and my community represented at this care center or the care team? Are there online materials or physical materials that speak directly to the needs of me and my community? You know, that lets me know that they are informed around my community and the needs I'm looking for. So you might have heard my little alarm letting me know that I need to wrap it up. You know, there's, in addition, do they have a relationship with any, again, care centers or support programs, so like an LGBTQ specific support group that I could get involved with and connected to so I can find community. So I'll wrap up there because I know that we have another speaker and more discussions that we'd like to have. But I hope this helps you find the care that I really feel like you deserve. And thank you so much for the time today.
Oh, thank you so much. That was just a wonderful presentation. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Jaramillo, and she's an oncology social worker, our Insights and Call Center Program Manager at Cancer Care. And Ms. Jaramillo will be addressing health literacy, how to become more knowledgeable and satisfied with your care, guidelines to improve telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes, and Cancer Care's free national psychosocial services and programs, our Hope Line, and our website. It's really my great pleasure now to introduce my esteemed colleague, Ms. Sarah Jaramillo, who's an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. Ms. Jaramillo.
Thank you so much for the introduction. Making decisions about your care can often evoke fear and it can seem intimidating, especially if you do not feel comfortable with your medical team or if you're a part of a population that often experiences disparities or discrimination. One of the best ways to combat fear or uncertainty is obtaining knowledge. Increased knowledge about your health can lead to feeling confident about the choices you're making and about your treatment journey. Health literacy is the foundation of being a participant in your own cancer care, and it refers to the ability to assess, understand, evaluate, and use health information to make informed decisions. Health literacy can help improve understanding of diagnoses and treatments, leading to evaluating risks and benefits of treatment options, and it could also empower patients to ask questions, weigh options, and make choices that are aligned with their values and preferences. And it also can help with reducing misunderstandings between patient and doctor communication and assist with managing anxiety related to treatments and side effects. So what are some ways that you can improve your health literacy? There are several ways you can, and these ways include asking questions to your medical team, whether you're in person or you have access to telehealth. Open notes is a practice or a system that allows patients to have access to the clinical notes written by their healthcare providers, and it's often through online patient portals. So these notes usually include details from doctor visits, test results, care plans, and provider observations. So the goal of open notes is to promote transparency, patient engagement, and improved health outcomes. So whether you're a caregiver or a patient listening in, I encourage you to explore obtaining access to open notes, and I invite you to write down and prepare questions that you may have about what you see in your notes for your next appointment. And this can help really improving doctor-patient communication, but also feeling a little bit more comfortable and empowered to make decisions within your care. Another way of improving health literacy is reaching out to reputable cancer organizations that can share resources as it relates to cancer, diagnoses, treatments, and anything related to emotional impacts. These organizations may have educational support services or other comprehensive services that may address any health disparities and targets health literacy. So Cancer Care is one of the leading national organizations that provides free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, and support groups over the phone, online, and in person, as well as educational workshops like this one, publications, financial, and copay assistance. All cancer care services are free of charge, and they're provided by Masters Prepared Oncology social workers and world-leading cancer experts. So to access any of our services, you may call our Hopeline number, which is 1-800-813-4673, or you may have access to our website, www.cancercare.org. Thank you so much for listening in, and I look forward to answering any questions that there may be at the end.
Oh, thank you so much. That was just a wonderful presentation, and I know there'll be questions for you definitely during the Q&A, so thank you so much. It's just a stellar presentation. Thank you, as always, Sarah, for just a wonderful presentation. We're now actually going to take questions from our experts, actually, and I'm going to ask Audra to explain to you how to queue up and ask questions. Audra?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So so this is a question for Dr. Pratt Chapman. Why isn't the topic of integrative health discussed before or along with doing chemo? How do we get to the integrative approaches and how to identify where to get that in kind of help also?
I think, you know, integrative therapies with cancer, kind of more traditional cancer therapies, is highly variable. So I definitely think if that is something, you know, if there's a social worker, if you feel comfortable talking to your oncologist, asking about the specific local options for integrative therapies and what might be optimal given your particular treatment plan, if there's anything that's contraindicated. You know, usually often massage therapy, Reiki, and other healing therapies are very helpful. Sometimes supplements and other kinds of things are not recommended with cancer therapy because of interactions. So I can't answer that in terms of a system level why it's not routinely integrated. I think that is unfortunately something that is still on patients and caregivers to advocate for if that isn't something that their care team brings up. But thank you for the question.
Thank you so much. We have a question from Dr. Blaz Bush. What about when you are told you have a rare case of cancer and there isn't data, info, or clinical trials? The oncologist chooses a treatment kin to a similar cancer, which has huge risks of side effects, and tries to convince you that you will do well on the treatment. The surgeon and oncologist are indifferent about the stage of cancer, remove stage 2 or 3. Confusing.
Thank you. If I understand correctly, you know, this is about when you're in a situation where there's a really rare treatment approach and cancer diagnosis that may not have a lot of options, and so what do you do? And, you know, I think that especially if there is such a rare approach and kind of it's undetermined between your different care team what the best advice is, I think this is a time where you can, you know, really come forward and bring up what's important to you, what would your concerns be, and you know, as my colleague spoke earlier, is there any second opinion? You know, I think especially in rare approaches, is there anywhere that you can look, or even just get a you know, teleconference kind of consultation with somebody else, even if they're not local, to see, you know, would you approach this any differently? And, you know, maybe there's not a lot of options in this case. I think at least knowing that there's not a lot of options, that other people wouldn't have a different approach, would be reassuring for me and have more trust in my team. And then again, I think even in these cases where options are limited, I still think you have a right to bring up what's important to you and have that be a factor in the conversation and in the care outcomes. And ultimately, you get to decide, maybe given the risks and benefit, what would feel best to you in this decision. You know, what, be able to talk about your goals, listen to that, be reflected and considered by your provider. Again, even if there's few options, you do always have an option in these cases. So you know, they need to be including what matters most to you, even in situations where there's not a lot of evidence or a lot of options.
Excellent, thank you. And this is an important one. Do you know of any specific trainings for healthcare providers that discuss the LGBTQ+ community and cancer care? Let's see, Dr. Pratt Chapman, do you want to discuss, start with that question and then others can join in?
Yeah, sure. So I actually built a really comprehensive training called Team SGM, but I haven't had the funding or capacity to make it all publicly available. There is a portion of it that's publicly available that is on the GW Learning Management System. It's called the Team Training. It's free, and it is an intersectional training with 5 continuing medical education units looking at health disparities among Black, Latino, and LGBTQ populations and strategies providers can consider for equity. I also know Dr. Stout may have some things he wants to weigh in on. They have a safe spaces training or welcoming spaces. I always mess that up. But that is also available and widely used. So I will defer to him in explaining that. But those are 2 sources of free training that are available with hopefully more to come as we navigate this kind of rocky landscape at this time with our current initiatives.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Bush, do you want to say more about that?
Well, I'm happy. I don't know if that was directed towards me, but Scout, did you want to share some of your resources first?
Did you want to add any resources here?
Well, I'm happy to add theirs. If you look at a you can search online for Teaching LGBTQ+ Health at Stanford Medicine. It usually comes up pretty quickly for me. And there's it's actually a faculty development course, but I think it's really helpful for any team of people that's interested in learning more, especially foundational information about how to care for ND LGBTQ folks. But there is a specific content that's focused on a lesbian couple that has a cancer diagnosis and how to include both partners in that decision making and talk through that diagnosis, being inclusive and affirming. So I think, folks, that would be a great resource for providers. In addition, I wanted to say that there's an SGM Cancer Care Conference through the Building Next Generation of Academic Professionals, BINGAP. They have an annual conference right now that trains folks. This is a lot on research, but I think that's a really important piece. And I think through training with research, you would also walk away with some great applicable skills. But as Dr. Pratt Chapman said, I think Scout also has some fantastic educational materials.
Excellent. Well, this has been really a superb program, I have to say. We have lots more questions, I can't take everyone's question, but I just wanted to comment on just the quality of the presentations, which was superb, and also the quality of our speakers. We are going to provide resources for all of you, those of you asking about more training. And there's one more question I just would like to, if someone could address this one. And I'll ask Dr. Pat Chapman if you could address this one. Let's see. My mom and I have discussed enrolling in a clinical trial, but her biggest concern is that everything will only be in English. How can we discuss this with her doctor, and is there anything that can be done to get materials in Spanish? Dr. Palos, could you address that?
Sure. Excellent question. One of the best things to do is, well, when you go to your doctor's office, find out, is there anyone there that speaks the language, the preferred language that your mom may have? And then if you're then going to look online for clinical trials, you can see if anything is available in Spanish. Now, before at the NCI, they used to have the clinical trials online, and they usually provided information, or at least not on every protocol, but on some in different languages. That may be changed given the current situation with all the changes towards diverse populations. What you can also do is find out, if you're in a large facility, there's usually translator services, so you can ask for a translator to be there. You don't really want to have a family translator because some clinical trials have, you know, complex situations or treatments associated with it. So it would be best to see if there's a translator there, and then that way the clinical trial can be explained. It's wonderful that your mom is even asking those questions because we do not have enough diverse populations in our clinical trials. So when they make recommendations, they're not being made on the general population of the United States or the mosaic of the United States population. It's usually being made on a select few who joined the clinical trials. So ask about translators, look online to see if there's any services that provide the clinical trials in Spanish, because this is essential even to the pharmaceutical companies and to all the other groups that provide clinical trials. And I would like to encourage you to keep on asking your physician about, you know, possible translation services or the need to have translation services if they want to get people into clinical trials. Good luck to both of y'all, because that is wonderful that your mom is even asking that question.
That is really incredible. And now, comment on just how wonderful all of our speakers have been and how wonderful all of our participants have been, that you really have this has been a program that we've offered before, but I have to say this one is the best ever. And I want to thank all of you for being on this program today. I do want to make a few comments. So, you know, for those of you who have been on the program before or on it now, I want you to know that you're the most incredible group we've ever had. Ask the best questions. And I would just like to say that be sure to continue asking your questions. Ask your questions always of your healthcare team. Continue to ask your questions. And one of the questions that we find that many of you have issues with is you know, many of you have difficulty reaching your physicians, no difficulty during the day, but evenings, weekends, and holidays seem to be a challenge. So please, everyone, be aware of that. You know, that is that's so important that you know how to reach your healthcare team, you know, on not only on weekdays, but on holidays and evenings as well. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, and I want to thank our speakers as well. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.